This is Elena Smith at Brookfield's Restaurant off of Taylor Road, and I am interviewing Tom Pedersen for the Department of Fish and Game Oral History Project with Dr. Castaneda. So, Mr. Pedersen, can you tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Sure. I'm a native Californian, grew up in the Bay Area, and spent a lot of time up in the Tuolumne County area of Twainhart. My grandparents had a cabin up there.
Mm-hmm.
So as a kid, I spent a lot of time hunting and fishing with my family and had a great interest in wildlife and the outdoors, and that's what led me to want to become a warden.
Wow. Can you tell me a little bit, what did you hunt and fish?
Mainly a lot of trout fishing.
Mm-hmm.
And some warm water species like bass and perch. Hunted a lot of big game, mainly deer, bear, and did some upland game hunting, quail and rabbits and squirrels. So just a variety of things, mainly just the joy of being out in the woods and being able to take advantage of the resource.
What was school like for you?
It was one of those things where I think I always wanted to go into wildlife law enforcement, but I majored originally in criminal justice. At the time, it was difficult to go to work for the department unless you had prior law enforcement experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the suggestion was to go to work for a state agency and then transfer over. And I went to work for the Highway Patrol in 1974, and I spent 4 years there before becoming a warden in January of 1978. I still had to take the test and do all the entrance requirements, but I was able to move across from CHP. I'd already been to an academy. And in those days, there was no field training officer program. And when I reported to duty, I was given my car and my equipment, and my lieutenant told me, if you have any questions, call me.
Wow. What was the CHP training like? Did it help you?
Oh, it helped me. It was general law enforcement, and I spent 4 years working in San Bernardino County down in the Bloomington-Fontana area.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I didn't have enough seniority to get a freeway beat, so I spent quite a bit of time just working in the unincorporated areas and learned a lot about people and how to deal with people, and that helped me when I went to work for the department.
So what was your first field assignment like?
My first field assignment, I was assigned as a Marine Warden in Monterey, and at that time spent a lot of time working commercial fishing industry in some sport. At that time, it wasn't quite as complex as it is now. I remember standing in the Monterey office one day and watching an individual come into the office, and he said, I want to become a commercial fisherman. And the clerk behind the counter said, fine, all you have to do is purchase a boat registration and your commercial fishing license, and you're good to go. And he went out the door, and I ran into him a few weeks later, and he was taking rockfish and selling them at the markets and selling them to the wholesalers. And it was a simple process. At the time, the limits weren't, there were no catch limits, or, you know, there wasn't a problem with trip limits like there is now. And the zones, there was really no requirement. They just went out and fished.
Wow.
And in those days, there was a commercial squid fishery, and there still is in Monterey, but it was a large commercial squid fishery. And at that time, squid that were taken were not utilized for table fare in California. The only reason anybody used squid at the time was to use it for bait, because there was still a pretty large commercial abalone fishery in California, so abalone was available, and it was kind of interesting. As the abalone declined, there was more interest in squid.
Interesting.
So the pressure continued to mount on the commercial fisheries of California, and that's led us to where we are today.
So in 79, you switched to land patrol.
Yes. I went to work, my position was Salinas, I was assigned to the Salinas Valley, and I worked pretty much all of Monterey County and San Benito County. A lot of big game enforcement at that time. Once again, like I said, we didn't have a lot of training, so all I knew was I knew how to hunt deer. I knew how to where the deer were, and the best advice I ever got is find the deer and the illegal activity that occurs out of season or at night will follow. And sure enough, I picked a road that I didn't know anything about, staked it out because there was a small herd of deer there. I staked it out for probably a week every night, and on the seventh night somebody showed up, and I watched this 1969 El Camino drive up the canyon. They stopped, turned off their lights. I couldn't see them. And then in the middle of the night, all I heard was shots. And I waited and I waited, and a few minutes later I heard a ka-plunk, ka-plunk. It sounded like something being loaded into the El Camino. So I waited until they began to leave, and I followed them in my 1968 Dodge two-wheel drive pickup with a six-cylinder engine. And I followed them out of the canyon and stopped. As I attempted to stop them, they decided to flee. They threw the rifle out the window, and the rifle was completely covered in camouflage tape. And they threw that into the field, and I didn't expect that, so I threw my citation book out to mark where they had thrown the rifle out of the car, ended up stopping the individual, and went back and found the rifle, and they had two deer in the vehicle they had killed, and arrested them for the violations, and that was kind of my first case.
Wow.
So it was interesting.
So tell me how you went about with the deer, as far as tracking the deer. Is there a special technique to that?
Or? Well, it's like a lot of things. In this particular case, there was a slight blood trail, and you know, you learn a little bit about tracking when you're a hunter, and that's why if you're going to be a game warden and you're going to be involved in hunting and fishing, it helps if you know a little bit about the culture.
Uh-huh.
And the majority of the people that are encountered by wardens are very law-abiding. In fact, they're incensed at the idea that people would take animals out of season or at night, and they're essentially just criminals, and they should be treated as such. But there's a technique to it. I learned it from other wardens. In fact, probably some of the most useful training I ever got was there were Border Patrol agents stationed in Monterey County, and their job was to track people, which is essentially what my job was. So I learned a great deal about how to track people, how to find a particular boot track. It actually, we were able to take photos and sometimes use that in court to show that people had entered private property at a certain point, and were able to track where they had gone and where they came out. And you could tell how many people were in the group, how old the tracks were by the condition. And it was, I spent a lot of time watching tracks, both of wildlife and people, because you watch the tracks of the wildlife, you can tell the crossings and the migratory paths of animals, and that way you know where the animals are, and then that way you know where to look for where the people are that tend to violate the law. And the legal ones, too, that just take the animals in season and help support the department with their license dollars.
So you said you learned a lot from the Border Patrol. What were your other connections with the law enforcement in the area?
Very dependent on the sheriff's office. The local sheriff's offices were very helpful to us. They were essentially our only support and backup. And in fact, in Monterey County, the individual that was the head of the communication center, Art McDowell, actually put sheriff's radios in all of the warden's vehicles in Monterey County. We had no dispatch system at the time. We had no formal dispatch system. That didn't come into place until sometime around 2004, where we contracted with state parks. We actually began a formal contract with state parks where they dispatch for fishing game. But prior to that, we were dependent on other agencies that were willing to take it on for us. And in this particular case, the sheriff's office where I was stationed was very helpful and always supported us. And had it not been for the sheriff's department, we'd have been in trouble, because the reality of it is, in many cases, the sheriff's department's the first one to get the call anyway, and they probably apprehend more people initially than game wardens do, but game wardens do more follow-up work.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about the follow-up work that you tended to do after the sheriff?
Yeah, it was kind of the early days of CSI. Our biologists and our lab people that worked for the department did a number of studies about the cooling rates of carcasses on animals that are killed. Mm-hmm. So you could stop someone at 2 in the morning, and they could say, well, I killed the deer during legal hours. And you could take your thermometer, put it into the animal based on the ambient temperature, the carcass temperature, and charts that were put together by our lab and biologists. We could tell by the temperature of that carcass when the animal was killed. So a lot of our cases were made based on that. Other things like hair samples and blood samples in a vehicle that someone said, I didn't do anything. You get a report of someone doing something illegal, like taking an animal out of season. You go to their house, they might have washed out the back of the truck, but you might find one or two or three deer hairs and a spot of blood, or a spot of blood on their boot, which leads you to it. But that was before DNA. Mm-hmm. So we didn't actually have the ability to determine from the meat of an animal which animal was killed by what, because sometimes they would kill multiple animals and put it all into one pile of meat. We weren't able to determine that, but in those days we were more dependent on blood samples, hair, and other forensic things. And we had a lab. We have a lab still to this day. There were two individuals at the time that worked in the lab that did a lot of our forensic work for us, and they were instrumental in making cases and would come down and testify in court. So the lab was critical to what a warden did in the field.
Wow. How did your background with regular law enforcement help you with the transition over? We're backtracking a little bit.
It helped a lot, because I think I had the opportunity to deal with general law enforcement, which wardens do encounter. They encounter a number of crimes just based on being in the field. It doesn't matter whether it's drugs or other illegal activity. When you're out in the middle of nowhere by yourself, you find things. So by having some experience in law enforcement, you learn a lot about people and how to deal with people, and it gives you a sense about how to work with other agencies, because you know how traditional law enforcement agencies work. And so all those things, I think, help you when you transition to fish and game, because in fish and game, you're really dependent on other agencies, because the warden force is so small and they're so spread out. And to this day, they still have essentially the same warden force they had in the 1960s. In spite of the increase in the population and all the additional duties that they have taken on, especially in the environmental crimes area. Mm-hmm. Because when Fish and Game was brought on board and became a department, they didn't have nearly the environmental crimes that they deal with now, whether it's stream bed alterations, pollution, illegal dumping, whatever the case may be. There's a lot of things that they've taken on over the years that the traditional warden of, say, the 1950s didn't deal with. I think during my tenure with the department, especially towards the end of the 70s, I think I saw the last of the just patrol type activities where the warden could set his or her schedule and go out and do whatever needed to be done. Now the calls for service, the depredation problems, the public safety problems with either public safety bears or lions or other animals is a problem, because you have to deal with those now. And so you don't really have the ability as a small force to go out and, as I would say, turn over rocks and find out what's going on.
Okay. So moving moving on to your transfer and your work with the oil in San Jose, can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. In 1982, I promoted to lieutenant, which is a first line supervisor, and I was assigned to the Bay Area, what was then the oil and pollution unit, which was a small unit. There was myself and two wardens, and that was before oil spill prevention and response was created. So our responsibility was working oil spills, pollution, dumping of illegal chemicals that impacted waterways and wildlife. And so we spent a lot of time working with the district attorney's offices, environmental crimes unit, and EPA, the federal entity that dealt with that. And so we had a task force at the time when I went into the Bay Area that worked those kinds of crimes. Highway Patrol had a member on the team, the district attorney's office, like I said, EPA, and other law enforcement agencies. So there was a good cooperative effort there. And at that time, we moved more into the civil filings, where we began to file for unfair business practices, where there were substantial civil penalties that were imposed on individuals that violated the law. And a lot of those monies went back to either the department or the district attorney's office to help support that unit.
Okay. So what were your concerns as a lieutenant? I think that's right?
That's correct.
As opposed to working as a boots on the ground warden?
Well, a field lieutenant is actually pretty well involved in the day-to-day activities, and it's probably one of the best positions in the department because you're still in the field, yet you have a little more autonomy. But I would say that as a lieutenant, you began to deal more with coordinating with other agencies, especially in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. As I'd mentioned earlier, we had a very small force. So it was important to coordinate with those other agencies, especially since they had many more resources than we had, mm-hmm. especially the DA's office. One of the DA's offices that was like Alameda County and Santa Clara County were exceptional, working with us and filing our cases. And we were able to get cases filed because one of the frustrations, I think, of environmental crimes or even just general fish and game crimes is in a highly populated area like the Bay Area, it's difficult to get filings with the district attorney's office. And in their defense, they have a number of other types of crimes they deal with, and they have a workload and they only have so many staff. Mm-hmm. But there seemed to be some of the agencies that were more environmentally sensitive than others, and Alameda County and Santa Clara County come to mind.
And how did tracking environmental crimes differ from things like tracking the deer poaching that you did earlier?
Well, it's the same concept. I mean, the investigative techniques are always the same. For instance, if you had a spill in a river, you know, when you're doing your, and there again, you rely on the lab extensively to do a lot of the analysis, you take a sample upstream from the point of entry of the pollutant, and you take a sample downstream. And if you have a suspect, whether it's a business or an individual, they're always going to argue they weren't the ones that did it.
Uh-huh.
So if you have a trail of a chemical leading into the stream, and you take the upstream sample and it comes back clean, and the sample at the point of entry is contaminated, as is the downstream, that's what helps you make your case in court because it proves the element of the violation.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept is the same. It's just a question of how you approach that particular thing. And water sampling and other sampling techniques that are done that we were trained in by our lab and other agencies were utilized.
Mm-hmm.
But the concept is the same. It's still an investigation. You're still interviewing witnesses. You're still gathering evidence. You're still going to the DA's office. Fish and Game just writes the reports. It's up to the district attorney. They're the ones who make the decision on filing.
Okay.
And so it's important to have all the facts and have everything down, even if it's a fact that may indicate that the party that was the suspect didn't commit the violation. What you really want to do is find the truth.
Uh-huh.
Whenever you investigate a crime, that's what you're looking for. You're trying to do your best to find the truth. And whenever you go to the district attorney, you want to tell them the good, the bad, and the ugly, and you want to make sure you're very truthful and honest. And it's not so much about this case, it's about your credibility for the future when you deal with that agency.
Gotcha. Moving back a little bit, how did you ever do any undercover work?
Yes, at the time, this was before the department had developed what they call the Special Operations Unit, which is a cadre of individuals that work strictly undercover. And they're a big asset to the department. But prior to that, wardens, there again, with a small force, you were dependent on doing everything yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember one particular case, there was a report of someone that had taken a lion illegally, and that it had been mounted and was for sale, and it was reported to us. And so what I did was, when I was a warden, with my lieutenant's permission, I posed as an individual that was interested in purchasing a lion, carcass, particularly a mount, and I went to this. It was a illegitimate taxidermist, shall we say, and went into the store and had another warden outside, used a wire, and had permission from the DA's office, and worked with the DA's office on it, and essentially got the individual to elicit information that they had actually taken the lion and mounted it and were interested in selling it for $1,000, gave him $1,000, walked out the door, got the uniformed officers in there and arrested the subject, and there we went down the road. We also had another case where an outdoor rider, who's still an outdoor rider and very successful at that.
What's an outdoor rider?
Someone that writes articles on hunting and fishing and sells them to various periodicals. For instance, the individual I'm thinking of is Tom Steenstra.
And can you spell that for me?
Yeah, I believe it's S-T-E-I-N-S-T-R-A. Now, the I and the E may be set maybe the other way, but Tom is his first name. He lives in Northern California, but he writes on a regular basis for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's been doing that for years.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he called myself and another retired warden by the name of Paul Maurer, who was my adjoining partner warden in Hollister.
Can you spell that one for me, too?
Yeah, Maurer is M-A-U-R-E-R. I may have one R in there too many. I think it's M-A-U-E-R. M-A-U-E-R, yeah. Paul. Paul's retired. He lives up in Sonoma County.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd been around long before I came to work for the department. He was a mentor to me. But essentially, Tom Steenstra called and said, look, I have these guys. They have a ranch over in San Benito County, and they are booking hunts allegedly for wild boar, when in reality what they're doing is they're purchasing pigs from a stockyard and they're releasing them, and they're bringing these hunters out there that unbeknownst to them are essentially shooting farm pigs.
Oh my gosh.
And they were making a lot of money, and it was despicable, actually.
Yeah.
But, and so Tom had booked a hunt, Tom Steenstra, and he wanted someone to go with him. So the decision was made that I would go with him, posing as another hunter, and that Paul, the other warden, would be outside in uniform, ready to make the arrest. So we went to this ranch and went out on this hunt with a guide, and they were licensed guides by the State Department of Fish and Game, and went on the hunt, drove around, they let the dogs loose. All of a sudden, here appears this huge 200-pound pink pig that looked like Porky Pig, and we walked up, and the guide was saying, shoot it, shoot it, shoot it. And you could see that it was marked, it had ear tags. I mean, it was clearly a domesticated animal, not a wild boar. And it turned and it ran around back behind this structure, and they had a pen in there with carrots and celery and all sorts of things, and the pig ran in back there, and the guy still said, oh, shoot it, shoot it. And we said, that's it. I identify myself as fishing game. We arrested he and several other people, and interestingly enough, I think I mentioned to you earlier, there was an individual who felt very badly that had gone up on this supposed hunt and killed one of these pigs and actually had it mounted on his wall and was just beside himself that this was just a domestic pig. So, besides the fact that he was conducting an illegal guiding operation, part of the reason that Fish and Game regulates those things is you want to have a level playing field. Mm-hmm. There are a number of guides that are completely legitimate, work very hard to get hunters into spots so they can harvest a mature animal. And it's not easy. They're usually down the bottom of a canyon or up the top of a mountain. And people work very hard for these things. So it's not fair for those other guides and those other individuals to be taken in by someone that's conducting this type of activity and making money off of poor innocent people that are just trying to do the right thing. So those are the kind of cases that we would get involved in. That one was a little more bizarre than most. But But they're, most people are, most of the guides are very legitimate, very honest, very hardworking, and you really don't want that to be the image of a guide.
No.
Right, so that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
How does it differ from working in uniform, working undercover?
Yeah, working undercover is a very different kind of an operation. There was another operation in the Bay Area. There was an undercover operation that was run by one of the lieutenants there named Miles Young.
Mm-hmm.
And they worked mainly take of illegal species of salmon, striped bass, things in the bay. And one time I was sent, because one of the undercover people wasn't available, I was sent to a bar in San Francisco to purchase two sturgeon that had just been taken out of the bay. And here's this dingy bar, and they sent me in there because they said I probably wouldn't make a very good undercover person, scrungy, so they sent me in there as the accountant for the business.
Uh-huh.
I went in, sat on the bar, still waited. These shady characters came in, and they were about half drunk, and all sorts of things going on. But went out to this car. They popped the trunk of this old Ford Galaxy, and in it were two mature sturgeon, still moving, that had been gaffed. And these sturgeon were probably 5 feet long, and they were out of season. And the sportsmen are not happy about that either, because these are sturgeon that should have been spawning, and they weren't because they were being taken out of season. Anyway, I purchased those. Same thing. We waited. Uniformed officers came in, raided the place, seized a lot of illegal fish and other game and exotic species they weren't supposed to have. And it just, one thing leads to another. Oh, and they had drugs. Of course. So that's how wardens get into these other things. There's just, you just can't avoid it. I mean, so it's, it differs a lot because you're dealing with a completely criminal element. Whereas when you're a warden in the field, the majority of your time, you're contacting families, you're contacting sportsmen in the field. You have to be a chameleon. In other words, if you meet a family of people like you at 2 in the afternoon, you treat and you act completely differently than if you're stopping a car at 2 in the morning where they're shooting out of the car, killing deer out of season, and they're probably, they're on drugs or alcohol, and they may have an extensive criminal record.
Uh-huh.
And,
were you okay, or did you want to order? So you were telling me about your childhood?
Yes. As I mentioned, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents up in the mountains in Twainhart. I spent my whole summers up there, and any time I could get away, I'd beg my parents to go up there. And I remember rode my bike into town. I was about 12, and I normally go in there because I wandered around with a little 22 rifle, a little single shot rifle, and my fishing rod, and I would go in there to buy my 22 shells and my worms and eggs and hooks and such. And there was a game warden car parked out in front of the store, first one I'd ever really seen. So I walked in, and the game warden was in there, and I asked him, what he did. And we, as kids, thought there was a game warden around every tree. So that's partly why we didn't violate the law. We knew, we just assumed there was that's the image a game warden had, and it stuck with us kids.
All present.
Yeah, all present. So, anyway, I asked him what he did, and he, he kneeled down and, you know, he was talking to me and telling me all about this, that, and the other. And suddenly a switch just, it's just like it clicked in my head that that's what I wanted to do. And from that point on, I was focused. And as I mentioned, when I was going through school, I decided, you know, I wanted to be a warden and I wanted to get on board. And I didn't mention, I ran into a fish and game captain at a gas station in the Bay Area. His name was Wagner, and he's long gone now, but he was a really nice person. And when I met with him, I said, you know, gee, how do I become a game warden? And he said, well, we don't hire very many. If you're smart, go into the highway patrol, get your training, get your academy, and then come across the fish and game. And that was how I got that idea.
Uh-huh.
So it was actually, and I think this applies to a lot of people, you find yourself in that position where you kind of find a mentor and they help you. And I didn't mention this either. When I was in Southern California, I was a highway patrol officer. There was a fish and game captain that lived in the neighborhood where I lived. And his name was, I can't remember his name now, but I'll think of it. Harrison, Tom Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
He's long passed away. But I didn't know him from Adam. So I got out of briefing one day at CHP, and I thought, I'm going to go by and knock on the door. So I drove my highway patrol car over to his house,
mm-hmm.
got out of the car, knocked on the door, said, hi, my name's Tom Pedersen, I want to be a game warden. And he actually hooked me up with a warden down in Elsinore, and I did ride-alongs, and I took the exam, and I eventually got hired. But that's how it started.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was just by the kindness of some of these people that took the time to talk to me.
Thank you.
And I tried to follow that same approach when I was in the department. You know, you're busy, you got a lot to do, but you got to realize that, you know, if people have an interest and they want to go to work for the department, that you owe it to them to at least spend the time to explain things and try to be helpful. So I think the department still does that.
Pay it forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. So did you do a lot of mentoring when you became a patrol lieutenant then?
Whenever I had someone that had an interest, we would try to do ride-alongs, and I think over the years there's probably half a dozen people I can think of that we tried to help that had a real interest in it. I know that one of the assistant chiefs I worked for, Chuck Monroe, he taught at the local college there in Napa. He's since passed away, but he was a mentor of mine, and he spent a lot of time trying to help individuals that wanted to come on in the department, and he was very helpful to me as I went up through the ranks in the department. So you remember people like that. They strike a chord with you, and I still have fond memories of the people that helped me. So that's pretty much that aspect.
The mentorship,
yeah,
it's so important.
I think it is. You know, I think that there's some people I've met that even though they may have come from a poor family background and they didn't necessarily have all the breaks everybody else did, if there's somebody, I don't care who it is, whether it's a coach, a teacher, whatever, a clergy person, who knows, but if they get that little bit of positive reinforcement that makes them think that they're worth something, I think that sometimes is what it takes to turn people around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To when you became a patrol lieutenant. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I worked in a number of positions. I worked in the pollution unit, as we discussed.
Right.
Then I transferred back to Monterey County, where I was a patrol lieutenant with, I had San Benito, Monterey, part of Santa Clara County, I think, probably had three counties, and I had a squad of, say, seven or eight individuals. And there again, it was more hands-on in that you're such a small unit that you work a lot in the field with the wardens, try to coordinate the activities, try to make sure that we covered things.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you're responsible for training and evaluations and all the types of things that go along with the day-to-day business of the department. But for the most part, the wardens were independent and they pretty much set their own schedules, and the wardens I dealt with by far were self-starters. They all wanted to be there, they did the right thing, and they tried to make sure that they used their time efficiently, and Always enjoyed it as a patrol lieutenant. It was probably one of the best jobs in the department.
How did it differ from being a lieutenant?
As a lieutenant to mm-hmm. from a warden? The warden, I think, has a smaller geographic area, but they have a lot of autonomy as far as the types of activities they work on. Mm-hmm. Whereas once you become a lieutenant, you're kind of more spread out. You're dealing a lot with other agencies, coordinating
right.
activities, and making, as a lieutenant, you did most of the filing of the cases with the DA's office. You were the liaison to the DA and the courts, because you had to make sure that cases were filed in a timely manner. If there were problems with a case, you had to intervene on that. You also started getting into having to investigate citizen complaints. If there was a complaint about somebody's demeanor or whatever in the field, even if it was minor in nature, you still had to investigate it, because if a citizen files a formal complaint, you have to investigate it.
Uh-huh.
So those are things that you get into that, you know, as a warden, you're pretty much free of. And you begin to learn that your time is not your own as a supervisor.
Were there aspects of that job that you particularly disliked, or?
I guess what I would say I disliked the most
Sorry
was...
Sorry to interrupt you one more time. I apologize.
No problem. Where were we? We were talking about the difference between
what you disliked.
What I disliked. I think what I disliked sometimes was having to tell people that they couldn't have the vacation they wanted because we had to have X amount of people in the field. Maybe the case lacked the elements to get a good prosecution with the DA's office, and you had to tell someone, no, we weren't going to file the case.
Oh.
Or even worse, sometimes, when you work for a department, there are policies that come down that don't necessarily always like, but you have to be the one to carry them forward.
Mm-hmm.
I know that those kinds of things are not always fun to do, but they're necessary, so you just do it and you move on.
Just like with any job.
Just like with any job.
So in 1990, you became the captain in Menlo. Can
yes.
you tell me a little bit
Yeah,
about
I went
it?
To the Bay Area, promoted to captain. The area was essentially all the Bay Area counties, San Francisco, Marin, Alameda, Contra Costa, down to Santa Clara. And there again, now you have, we also had a patrol boat on the bay.
Mm-hmm.
So you're supervising a patrol boat, skipper and crew, and then a land operation consisting of maybe three or four lieutenants and 25 or so wardens, and they're, like I say, with their diverse duties, I mean, they had everything from, they had an importation warden at the airport that was working with the federal agencies to ensure that the species being imported or exported were legal, both state and federal. You had, like I say, the pollution, you had a lot of sport fishing, we had our little undercover operations that we did, and the pollution aspect, you know, because and calls for service.
Uh-huh.
You're dealing with a very populated area, and people with, you know, raccoon problems or a problem mountain lion or a problem, you know, we had falconry, so we had prohibited species sometimes that we dealt with. And so there's just a variety of things that on a day-to-day basis, the whole goal was just to keep things moving and try to handle the calls for service and try to do the other jobs that needed to be done with a limited amount of people. And I think that's the key to the whole thing, is that fish and game enforcement is very understaffed.
Mm-hmm.
And that regardless of whether you're talking about in my tenure with the department or now or back into the 1960s, I think the problems have always been the same, that the department is strapped with a number of duties and responsibilities and mandates without the funding and the resources to do it, so you have to prioritize
mm-hmm.
and make the best use of your time. And I think that's the key.
How did you prioritize?
Basically, priorities were calls for service from the public, because that's who we work for.
Mm-hmm.
The higher priority crimes, like illegal commercialization, certainly is a higher priority than, say, sport fishing over limits or whatever, because every time a fish plant would occur in a Bay Area lake, someone would call in that someone was taking over limits. Well, that's a problem, but it's not as big a problem as taking salmon out of the bay with a gill net. So
yeah.
you try to prioritize your activities based on that. And that's, I think, as I got into that position, especially in the 90s, we were finding that we had to start doing more dedicated patrols that were assigned based on the activities that were occurring at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a balancing act, because we still wanted to have the time to go do the other things, like I always say, turning over the rocks to find out what's going on, because that's the purpose of patrol. Any patrol unit, part of their job is to be out in the field, whether it's making contacts with landowners or sportsmen or individuals, and trying to get a sense of what's going on, and then based on that they can identify where the problems are. So as you get away from having enough people to do patrol time, in any organization, the patrol function is always the backbone in any law enforcement organization. And getting back to my traditional law enforcement experience, if the patrol function is not adequately funded and staffed, everything else suffers, because you don't make the kinds of cases that you would normally have if you have a patrol function. So, investigations is important, undercover is important, but by and large, the patrol function that goes out and handles the calls and does the day-to-day function, they're the most important aspect of Fish and Game's law enforcement program. So without enough staffing to do that, you're stymied to some extent in the other aspects of it.
You're almost forced into a reactionary position.
Absolutely.
It sounds like.
I think that's it in a nutshell. And so if you're always reacting, you don't ever have the time to plan and organize and direct the kind of activities that need to be done. So that was always that was very important, and that was probably the cornerstone of how you operated a squad in a place like heavily populated Bay Area.
Where did environmental pollution fall in, since it was such a heavily populated area?
Very high. In fact, I would say it was the highest priority, because the reality of it is, one spill of thousands of gallons of whether it's a petroleum product or a chemical can have devastating long-term impacts on the resource. So those types of incidents were always of the highest priority, and then everything else fell in behind it. So, and I think that was especially in the Bay Area, because of all the refinery activity and different things like that, there was always some minor spill or problem occurring on any given day.
Oh man.
So that was where the environmental aspect of it became very important, especially the more the population increased and the industrial base increased, and there was just more infrastructure in the Bay Area, more entities that dealt in chemicals and petroleum products. There was, whether it was a gas station that had a spill that went into a storm drain that went into Penitentia Creek in Santa Clara County, or whether it was a refinery where they had a break in the line and it went directly into the bay. So those are the kind of things that you just deal with on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. That is a lot.
But it's very important.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
No question. So can you tell me a little bit about Monterey when you transferred there?
Monterey was always one of my favorite areas. I think the important thing about Monterey is that before the Monterey Bay Aquarium was there,
I
love the aquarium too, but when I first reported there in 78, Cannery Row was just, looked like bombed out Beirut. Abandoned buildings, they'd found a body down there one day, and transient that had died in there. I mean, to look at it now and look at it then, it was completely different. The Monterey Bay Sanctuary wasn't in place. That evolved and became a reality. So the department, as far as enforcement goes, a lot of our emphasis was on marine species because of the pressure on the species. All the low tides, for instance, abalone are always at risk because there's always the individual out there. I'm not worried about the illegitimate individual, but at the time there was a lot of problems with people just showing up on the weekends, especially on a low tide down at Asilomar. They'd take the jackhandle out of the back of their car and go out and get some abalone. Well, as you know, once you harm the abalone and you injure the foot, it's a dead animal. It's over. So the whole purpose there was to educate and ensure that people complied with the regulations. Same thing with the sport fishing regulations on the ocean. But yet at the same time, there are a lot of coastal streams there with steelhead runs. Uh-huh. So you're having to protect the steelhead at the same time and essentially babysit the steelhead during critical periods when they're on the red spawning and they're very vulnerable to illegal activity from people, you know, using gaffs and spears and everything like that. And those aren't the majority of the people, but they're enough of a problem that you have to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, you've still got the inland activities because you've got deer and wild boar and all those things. And essentially, it's just one of those areas that's just special and deserves a lot of attention from the department.
Can you tell me a little bit about how your role I think it was the Marine Sanctuary Supervisory Board. Can you tell me a little bit about...
Right. One of my assignments I was assigned to the... it was an enforcement representative to the Pacific Fisheries Management Council, and they're the council that oversees setting the regulations that impact how the states do business. And our role, and there were enforcement coordinators from Oregon, Washington, California, and also from the Federal Fisheries Service on this committee.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose was not so much to influence what the council did, because obviously that was their call. But our job was to make sure that whatever regulations were put in place were enforceable. So we called it the clear blue line.
Uh-huh.
So that if someone decided they wanted to enforce X, we needed to make sure that the regulations were written in such a way that they would be enforceable. So our role was a support role.
Mm-hmm.
To essentially take whatever regulations were being put forth and put them in a format where they could be enforced by the wardens in the field.
Okay.
And that was very interesting because I got to spend a lot of time with other agencies, specifically my counterparts in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and in the feds. And so we had a lot of commonalities, and I really enjoyed that. I did that for several years, and it was very interesting, and I learned a lot.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the public outreach? I think you said you did a fair amount of it in Monterey.
Yeah, public outreach, I've always thought, is really important for enforcement. It's kind of a form of, in traditional law enforcement, there's community policing, which is essentially to get people out of their cars and out to meet the public and find out what's going on. So I think that the department has done a pretty good job of trying to reach out to the various communities, whether it's, for instance, when the Vietnamese first came to the United States after the war, a lot of the immigrants came to California, and because they had a lot of experience in fisheries, a lot of the people that were immigrating to the United States got into commercial fishing.
Uh-huh.
And they took over almost niches that had been the same niche that had been taken originally when the Italians came as a group to the United States. And so what you have is you have groups of people coming in and they want to do the right thing, but it's really important. So we did outreach to the community. We tried to put a lot of the regulations into languages that would be understood by the individuals. We made presentations at various organizational meetings to try to get the outreach, because the whole purpose of enforcement really is you have to educate.
Uh-huh.
The citations and the arrests and all that, you know, it sounds exciting and everything, but that's not your major goal is to get voluntary compliance with the law. And if you can get the majority of the folks behind you in the community, the rest will follow, because they will in turn turn in people that are violating the law.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we found with And I just use the Vietnamese as an example. The leaders of those organizations were very helpful to work with the department, and I think we had a very successful transition for folks that were immigrating. And now you look, those same folks that just came in, they're very successful business people. Their children are successful. I mean, it's you know, for instance, with the Vietnamese, you would go into a house, and maybe there would be, the first year they were there, there were, you know, maybe three families living together. The next year, they bought a house next to them, and now there were only a couple families. And within 5 years, everybody had a home, and they just continually built the business and worked hard, and, you know, they had a work ethic. So it was kind of interesting to watch as a transition, as you watch these groups come in, and you know, especially since our portion of it was fishing, commercial, the time spent on the education paid off in the long run, because you don't have enough people to enforce every law, and the courts don't have enough time to deal with every law. So really, you're depending on the public to police themselves, and that's what you would find. Pretty soon, you'd have community leaders telling other people, no, you can't do that, and pretty soon, the community was behind you, and then therefore, when it did come time to do enforcement, you got that public support. And without the public support, you're dead in the water. If the public doesn't believe in what you're doing, you're done, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. Because then you get the DA on board, and you know, the DA is an elected official. And so if the DA is on board because the public's on board, it all follows suit.
That is so cool.
I think it was interesting. I was more pleased about that than just about anything else that we were able to accomplish in the department.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think it was. And we learned a lot from the people, too, about their culture and, you know, how they did business, and very hardworking, you know. And so when you take somebody that comes to a country that has nothing and starts out with nothing and can't even speak the language, it does show that the American dream is still alive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, that is. So in 2002, you were promoted to assistant chief.
Yes.
That sounds like a big jump, was it?
Well, I went from, essentially you have like in an area, you'll have an assistant chief, and then you'll have three or four captains, mm-hmm. you know, eight lieutenants, maybe 60 wardens or however the chain of command goes. But when you get into that role, I had essentially 13 counties and a staff of probably 60, 70 people, that essentially at that point in time, you are clearly involved in managing the operation into budgets, justifying budgets, overseeing a lot of the administrative responsibilities. I mean, you want to be involved in the field, but the reality of it is you've taken on a lot of other duties that take away your time. So at that point, your best bet, at least from a supervisory standpoint, is to try to go to squad meetings when you have groups of people assembled. Try to communicate, you know, what the chief or the director of the department and the policies they're trying to put forth, and especially if they're not popular policies. And you want to try to show why these policies are in place and what, you know, you're really trying to get the message down to the troops on the ground that are actually out there doing the work, and you want to try to get their support and try to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Almost like you were doing with the Vietnamese, it sounds like.
Yeah. I really think that's the most important part. I mean, some people would like to say, oh, you know, you're still a game warden, you're still out there doing that. Well, you are a game warden. Everybody's a warden. But the reality of it is you've got a little different job.
Mm-hmm.
And you want the game wardens at the ground level, where they're out doing the job, meeting the public, carrying out the department policies. You really want to buy in from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of it is it's a sales job, in the sense that you have to convince them that what you're doing is in the best interest of the resource in the department.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, wardens are very independent by nature, and they're not stupid. You know, they understand how things work, and so if you're going to tell them something, you better tell them the truth. So even if you have to give them the bad news, they'll accept that, but you don't want to try to snow them on it.
Gotcha. You said you were dealing with the budget, and I think that's about the time the budget started going downhill for the state.
Yeah, it was tough because, you know, when our budget, 80% of our budget is essentially operations, mm-hmm. and especially with a warden, what's very important to a warden is their equipment. They essentially live in that vehicle. You know, they're camping out, they're sleeping in it, they're depending on that vehicle, they're chasing people at high rates of speed. You know,
hopefully
they're out
it's not still a six-cylinder.
No, they definitely had advanced. Yeah, things were improved. I think at one point I even had a Rambler station wagon as my control vehicle. But anyway, the equipment is really important because without the appropriate equipment and the necessary monies for gas, which is a very expensive item, you cannot do a patrol function because that's what you do. So the whole idea was to try to convince the director and the chief that we needed X amount of resources and that we were there to do a job. And thankfully, you know, at least in my tenure with the department, had people above me that understood that and were very supportive, and we were able to do that. Sometimes I don't know how they did it, but they did it.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's what keeps the morale up, is to keep the equipment and the overtime monies and all the things they need to do their job. Without that, that's when you start having serious problems.
Mm-hmm. So, in 2003, you jumped right to chief.
Yeah, I was pretty fortunate. I worked for a chief at the time. I reported to Greg Larratt was the chief. He's since passed away.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Larratt, can you spell that?
L-A-R-E-T, Greg Larratt. Yeah, he was the chief of enforcement. He was my predecessor, and mm-hmm. he was just a unique individual. Very good. He was a mentor to me. He was very ethical, very interested in what everybody was doing, and he always tried to do everything to help the troops in the field. And anyway, I worked for him, and the director at the time was Bob Height, and the chief's job came open because Greg was going to retire. A number of people put in, and I put in, and one day I got a call to come visit or have an interview with the director. The director asked me a number of questions about, you know, my philosophy about outreach and what's our mission and how do you view enforcement and where do they fit in, and just had it was more like a conversation like you and I are having, and it was a good conversation. Anyway, he chose to hire me, and so I went to work in Sacramento, which was a change because I sold my house in Monterey and moved, and my wife retired, and we went up to Sacramento and have been there ever since. But I think what was important at the time, we were going through, the state was going through a severe budget problem, and the department was subjected to a number of cuts, and one of the cuts was in the warden force. So as I mentioned earlier, at the time, the warden force reported to a civilian,
mm-hmm.
even though they were sworn peace officers, as did the other functions like wildlife management and fisheries. And the discussion at the time was, how do we make the enforcement unit more efficient? And how do we get more boots on the ground? And because the warden is the most important function that there is in the enforcement division. The other folks are in there, but the wardens are the ones in the field doing the work. So I had discussion with the director, and that by that time a new director had come in, Ryan Broderick, who had come up through enforcement. And the strategy was, how do you get these cuts without sustaining severe losses in the field? And there were other people that had, for years, one of the previous chiefs, Dwayne Johnston, had advocated for a straight line function because it's more efficient and we could utilize the resources better. So the challenge was to put together a plan to do that. And so with all the assistant chiefs that I had, a number of really good, solid people, some of them you may interview, we put together a plan to make the enforcement unit more efficient and make it a straight line organization, meaning that they would go from warden to the chief to then the director instead of warden to a regional manager and then over to the director, and the chief was bypassed because the chief at the time was more of a policy setter. So to do that, we looked at all of the then regions, which were structured by counties, and we found that we didn't have to go with those regional lines if we had enforcement people in that spot that we could use more efficiently. As I mentioned earlier, as an example, two adjoining regions at the time cut a county in half, where we had Contra Costa County, where we had a hierarchy of enforcement on one side, a hierarchy on the other side. Even though they were two regions, they were the same enforcement folks. So what we did was, ultimately, we reduced the number of supervisors, reorganized the squads, so we had, we were able to take 20% of the supervisors and convert those to warden positions. So essentially, we put 20% more wardens in the field, with no loss of staff, and we're able to make it more efficient and more straight line without doing anything other than reassigning personnel, and as positions became vacant, they were reassigned. So we took areas and reassigned personnel and reduced the number of supervisors at the same time. So in the end, we actually had more wardens in the field than we had before. That was and our director at the time, Ryan Broderick, bought off on it and made that change. And to his credit, he was able to generate the political will to make that decision, and I'm always be thankful for that, because it, in my opinion, it's increased the not only the efficiency of the warden force, but it's also brought the warden force to the level within the department they needed to be.
How did the personnel in the warden force react to that change?
The warden force, as a general rule, was very supportive of going straight line, because there's not a traditional law enforcement organization I know of that doesn't have straight line supervision. And even the wardens that were either reassigned or reconfigured, and there were some hardships, there's no doubt about it. They had to take a number of steps that were outside of the norm that they were used to dealing with. And to their credit, as a unit, I think they all stepped up and they did it. I was very proud of them myself. I think there was a fellow by the name of Joe Mello, who was the president of the Wardens Association at the time. And he, in spite of all the problems it caused, he knew, as did I think the warden force in general, that it was the best thing for the force to do that. So I think everybody fell into place, got behind it, and made it a success. And it's still in place today. And at the same time, I think I mentioned to you, we had other monies available then, that we had never had a full-time dispatching center, which meant that there was no way to track a warden in the field at night in every part of the state, because we didn't have dispatch capability. So one of my other tasks from the director was to go to state parks and try to put together a radio program. I did this when I was still the assistant chief as a pilot project. So we worked with Monterey State Parks Dispatch, which dispatched for the central part of the state. They're called CENCOM. And they took on wardens at the time as a pilot project, and it was successful. And so we contracted ultimately, when I became chief, for the whole state to take on the pilot project as a full statewide project. So even today, we have statewide dispatch throughout the state because of the ability of state parks to work with fish and game. And there were the little oddities when that first came into place. I remember State Parks was really good about it, but I remember some of the rangers were upset that they wouldn't get as much service because they now had wardens, and you know, there were a few wardens that had problems. But as personnel changed and everybody got to know each other, it all worked out. And it was a fascinating project. But my hat was always off to State Parks. There was the supervisor of dispatching down there at the time in Central Monterey. Her name was Lois Harder, and we're still friends. And she took on the hardship of doing that, and it worked. And it was just because people put the effort forth to do it, And so that's how changes take place.
So would you recommend this job to someone like me?
I would recommend it to anybody that has an interest in the out of doors. Mm-hmm. I still think that it's very helpful to have a hunting and fishing background. Only because the majority of the monies that still fund the department come from the hunting and fishing license buyer, and I think they deserve a certain level of service. Not that the other members of the of California's public don't deserve service. I believe they do. But I think if you're going to be involved in regulating something, mm-hmm. it's very helpful if you have some background in that entity. Whether you're a building inspector and you worked in the trades before you became a county building inspector, or any other business that you might be in, it really helps to know a little bit about the business. And I found the people that are the most successful seem to have that background. But I would recommend it to anybody. You know, I loved every minute of every day that I was there. When I retired, somebody asked me why I was retiring, and I said, I'm retiring for the same reason I came to the department. I love to hunt and fish. And so when I retired, I had more time to do that. So, yeah, I would recommend it. I think it's a unique job. I think it's a job that you really have to have a dedication above and beyond the call of duty, and I think that wardens are underpaid, and I'm hopeful that they'll get the same status that they deserve. But I think as far as a job goes, I couldn't ask for a better job or a better career.
What advice would you have for a warden just coming out of the academy?
I think the advice I have for a warden coming out of the academy is listen a little bit to the experienced people around you. When you move into your area of responsibility, I think make every effort to get to know the community, become part of the community. You know, when you're the warden and you're in a rural area, you're always going to be a little bit on the outside because, you know, you are the person enforcing the law. But I think the more you can integrate into the community and get to know people and learn that, and for people to learn about you and learn that they can trust you, because most of the cases I ever made, I'll hate to admit it, weren't really made by my great efforts. They were based on informants that would give me information and call me because they trusted me. And my policy was, once somebody told me something, I never repeated it. I would never reveal my source. I would never reveal. And I think the important thing is to be fair with people. You have to be firm, but you want to be fair, because even if you get somebody that's lived in the backwoods all their life, they all have a highly defined sense of fairness, and they can tell when somebody's mistreating them or not. So if you always treat people fairly, you'll always come out ahead. If you mistreat people or misrepresent the facts, or as someone told me when I first went to work, don't lie, don't steal, and tell me the truth, and we'll all get along fine. So that would be my advice.
Well, thank you very much for
your time. You're very welcome.
It's good to have the interview.